Welcome to the Original Gangsters podcast. I am your host, Scott Bernstein. Very special edition of the pod where we're going to bring on one of the true great retired G-men in New York history, Neil Moran. He worked organized crime in New York City for three decades. Was a major mob buster when it came to multiple crime families, the Gambinos, the Lucchese's. He has an outstanding new book called Stories, and he's come onto the pod to tell us some stories from Stories. Neil, thanks for joining me, buddy.
And thank you for having me, Scott.
So in our last episode, where we brought you on, we talked about the Paradiso brothers, Mickey Boy and Philly, and I think we're going to start back off with an anecdote from Neil's work with the Paradisos, and then we're going to talk about the Lufthansa heist and his working the Lucchese crime family, and then talk a little bit, go back to the Gambinos a little bit. So I'll turn it over to Neil.
Thanks again, Scott, for having me. So when I last spoke with you and your audience, the intro that I gave to our relationship with Philly Paradiso was that he began to cooperate, and we met with the Rackets Bureau, the Brooklyn DA's office. And one of the things that I did want to circle back on that I neglected to at the end of the our discussion was, Philly was insistent on the DA's office giving him $5,000 back that had been seized by the narcotics folks at the Brooklyn DA's office in a drug investigation where his co-defendant was a guy named, coincidentally, Red Moran. And he said, I want that money back. That's my money. It never went anywhere. We were never prosecuted. I want that money back. So Philly was cooperating with us for probably the better part of the year. And there came a time toward as things started to wind down and those homicides and our recovery of the body of Annette DiBiase and the things I talked about in the last session, things began to wind down. He said, you know, I can set up a drug deal with Anthony Tony Roach Rampino.
One of the Gotti crew.
One of the Gotti crew, and reported to be a backup shooter of Paul Castellano and Tommy Bilotti.
Yep.
So we were very intrigued by this, and he said, "I can definitely buy heroin from him." We spent time—I forget what jail it was, what institution it was upstate—but the two were in jail together, and the two, I think it's pretty well known that. The major reason why Anthony Rampino was never made into the Gambino family was his drug history.
Yes.
And quite surprising that John Gotti and the hierarchy of the Gambinos trusted Tony Rampino as much as they did, given the fact that, you know, he did have a long history of drug use and drug dealing. So there came a time when Philly said he could do this. Told us that he had arranged to meet Rampino in the Caesars Bay shopping center right off the Belt Parkway. And I took Philly into a bathroom stall of a Wendy's with $5,000 on me and wired him in the stall. And we had not only people from our squad monitoring this, but also people from the organized crime squad and the drug squad. So there was a lot of people out there surveilling Philly. And this went on. So I was driving at the time, as your audience is probably well aware, there came a time when federal agencies were able to seize cars in the course of investigation. So all of us drove really nice cars. Yeah. I had a really beautiful Cadillac sedan DeVille I drove, and it was wired. It was wired. So I gave this car to Philly, so he could look impressive to Tony Rampino. And again, if the deal was going to be done inside the car, it would all be there was a possibility it would be done outside the car. So the backup was to put a body recorder on him, but also to have the car wired in case they did it inside the car. So in any event, it seemed like, at least an hour or two went by and people are starting to wonder what's going on. Suddenly, how this ever happened, Philly eluded the surveillance, right? This was literally right in the shadow, right off the Belt Parkway. I remember somebody saying, do you have him? No, I don't have him. Do you have him? Nope, I don't have him. Philly took off with the $5,000. So we're talking like 1987. We're talking about the spring of 87, probably like May of 87. And $5,000 was a lot of money in 1987. Was it $25,000 today? I saw my entire career flash, as did people that were working with me. We saw our entire careers flashing before our eyes. Would I have a job? Would I get fired? It was a very, very upsetting time. Anthony Rampino never showed up. He had never contacted him. Philly wanted his money, and this is the way he was going to extract the money from us and the DA's office. Even though it was FBI money, the DA's office had nothing to do with it, and now I was on the hook for it. So, needless to say, George Hanna and I tried to track down Philly, every haunt imaginable. It was a famous place called the J.D. Motel right off the Belt Parkway. That was one of the first places that we tried. He had been there, showed his photo. Oh, yeah, he was here, come and gone. He had a lot of people with him. We had to throw them out. They were all drunk, drinking all night, upsetting the other patrons. Then we went into Manhattan. I don't know how many hotels we hit in Manhattan, all Fleabag hotels. And yep, he was here. Yep, sure. We know this guy. He'd been here. We kicked him out. About a week later, we found Philly. He had about 10 bucks on him. He had spent the entire $5,000 and he had gotten what he wanted. So now George Hanna and I are in deep trouble, and we're told, you got to discontinue your relationship with Philly and no more money. We don't care who he's going to buy heroin from. But he actually convinced the DA's office that he actually could buy heroin from Anthony Rampino. And the DA's office got money together. And in June, I think it was June, late June 1987, an undercover detective was introduced to Anthony Rampino and bought an eighth of a kilo of heroin from him, almost pure heroin, I think it was 0.88 heroin. And Anthony Rampino was subsequently arrested and started to cooperate with my partner, George Hanna, and another agent, Phil Scala. They had him on. He was terrified. Needless to say, John Gotti found out about this. I'll be toast. So he did indicate that he wanted to cooperate, but the only requirement was he wanted to be back out on the street. And nobody went for that. The DA's office didn't go for that. So he reneged on his cooperation. He says, I'll give you the shooters of Paul Castellano and Tommy Bellotti, but I need to be back out on the street.
This was 87?
87, June 87.
He was offering to give up the shooters?
Offering to give up the shooters.
Wow.
So that never went anywhere. And subsequently, Anthony Rampino he went to trial and before Judge Leslie Crocker Snyder. And she sentenced him, I believe, to 25 years to life. While he was in, he did file for compassionate release. I believe that was denied. He died several years ago. I don't know whether it was in prison or whether he actually ever did get out. But that I wanted to circle back with that because I did. That was my entree yesterday when I talked about Philly. That was in his mind. That was his money. And the investigation never went anywhere. And there was no way the DA's office was giving him that money back. But he got his money back. And for a couple of days of just a drunken and who knows what else binge. So that was kind of the end of the relationship with Philly.
I'm glad you shared that story with us. That was great.
Yeah. Not, so I'm sure Anthony Rapino is known to your audience. You know,
yeah, everybody knows Tony Roach.
Kind of a legendary figure in the Gambino family.
Yeah, somebody that, whose legend precedes him, not necessarily for the same reasons other guys from that crew, because of, the heights that they reached in the mob. Tony Roach never really reached those heights, but being around Gotti and having the nickname, the way he operated, his reputation preceded him too, just in a different way than some of the powerhouses. Right. So talk about your work on Mufasa, if you can, and the Lucchese crime family, and Tommy Stabile, who was the brother of Anthony Stabile, who we hear or we see in the movie Goodfellas.
Right. So in December of 78, December 11th, I'm not sure which day it was, 1978, the Lufthansa terminal is robbed by five or six armed men with ski masks. We regular day going into the office, I think it was a Monday morning, and our boss tells a couple of us to get out to the Lufthansa terminal. There's been an armed robbery out there. Could be a lot of money. That's the only thing that I recall him saying. Could be a lot of money. It's a big deal. Now, we have an office. The FBI's got a resident agency out in JFK Airport. It had always been out there for years. And there was a longtime boss out there named Walter Yost. He was your, I talk about it in the book, he was your quintessential John Dillinger era G-man. He was an older guy at that stage, very imposing figure, about 6'3", 6'4", fedora, never saw him without a trench coat. And quite, as I said, quite a legendary figure in the New York office. So we get out there and Walter is huddling with the Port Authority Police Department. And then we come to learn that about $6 million had been taken from the Lufthansa high value area. And basically, Walter told us, from what I recall, that the Port Authority has some leads here. We're going to work with them. We don't know if there's much for you guys to do out here today. So we actually went back to the office and, told the boss that, and they were kind of handling it. And a day or two went by, and then informant information began to be developed that this was a high-level organized crime case, and it would be transferred to our squad, which was the truck hijacking squad, and headed by Steve Carbone. So now all of a sudden, it's all hands on deck, and they're grabbing people from every squad in the New York office for 24-hour coverage on all the subjects of the investigation. Some high-level organized crime informant had gotten wind of who actually were the upfront people, and the fact that it was engineered by the Lucchese, by the Paul Vario faction of the Lucchese family, and of course, James Jimmy the Gent Burke, reputed to be the engineer of the entire operation. So I was assigned to the not too glamorous hours of 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., and I was assigned to an individual, one of the upfront people called Angelo Seppi.
Yeah, and so just to let people know real quick, Angelo Seppi, the character from Goodfellas that was based on Angelo Seppi was, I think they called him Frankie Carbone, and he's the one that they found in the meat locker.
Right.
That's who Angelo Seppi was, that's who that character was based on, Angelo Seppi. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the movie, it has a lot of accuracies, but that's obviously inaccurate, because I'll get into it later, but Angelo was murdered, but not as a result.
No way. It was Richie Eaton who they found in the meat locker. But yeah, Angelo Seppi was murdered later on with his girlfriend in their apartment. Go ahead.
So there is a scene in the movie where one of the upfront people comes into the Robert's Lounge with the girlfriend. She's got the furs on,
yeah, and they just love
a Cadillac. And
well, Jimmy, it's my mother's name. It's my mother-in-law's name.
Right. Robert De Niro is, you know, the Jimmy Burke character is ticked off. And, you know, what are you doing? Not too much is made of it, but Angelo Seppi did the exact same thing.
Right.
What his ride that he purchased was the single most popular car in Howard Beach in Ozone Park. So the next time you and your audience watches Goodfellas, at the scene where Robert De Niro and Ray Liotta are in the diner and they're waiting word whether Tommy DeSimone is getting that he was about to be made, Joe Pesci is about to be made. Robert De Niro goes out to make the phone call. In the background is that car. Navy, beautiful looking car, two-tone, navy blue body, rust vinyl top. You couldn't go a block in Howard Beach or Ozone Park and not see that car. Angelo had that car. He got that car. So I'll tell you what, it was an easy car to follow. The taillights were it was a 79 Thunderbird. The taillights were very distinctive. Now, he had in-laws in Matatuck, Long Island. And in addition to bouncing around, he kept us hopping, you know, six nights a week. This guy didn't sleep at all. The day shift had the best shift because he was asleep most of the day, but he kept us bouncing on a regular basis. And if he wasn't bouncing by himself or with friends in Brooklyn or Queens, he was with his wife, Hope, riding out to the in-laws at some ungodly hour. And that particular winter was a tough winter. It was very snowy. So that obviously made it easy for us to surveil him too, because he couldn't go too fast. But you'd see dozens of cars on the LIE in front of you, and you could spot his car and not have to be on his bumper because of the distinctive taillights. So there did come a time where they got court authorization to install a listening device into Angelo's car. You know, these things take forever. They go at the highest levels of the government, of the attorney general, as far as approval. It had to be a good 4 to 5 weeks after the robbery before we finally got the installation of the listening device in Angelo's car. And sadly, there were a couple of Lufthansa references, but not enough to charge him. He was arrested with Jimmy Burke several months later, and they didn't cooperate. Neither one of them, needless to say, cooperated. But a lot of humorous things went on, you know, following him. He was a big, I say in the book that it would have been nice if he was a Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin fan. We could listen to nice, relaxed music. He was a fan of the Grateful Dead.
Right.
And he loved that song, you know, Casey Jones, High on Cocaine. Well, follow that train, High on Cocaine.
Yeah.
We all hear that in our sleep. I mean, that was the only thing that we ever heard from inside the car. And then arguing with his wife on a regular basis. You have to appreciate the equipment that we had back then. Single person cars. I'm in the car by myself. You have a cassette recorder in the car, and you need to be fairly close enough so it will record. I have to admit, I don't know what kind of technology they have today, but I'm damn sure that it's nothing like that. So we had so many people on because of the fact that we had to do that, follow him fairly closely. All right. I said before that, you know, we could follow him at a distance, but those were other people. The one car that was recording had to be in fairly close proximity. Otherwise, you wouldn't be recording anything. So he was quite a character. He was quite a character. And later, he was reputed to be related to some high ranking members of the Colombo family. He did have a thriving drug business. And I believe it's 1984. He and a girlfriend were murdered in their Bath Beach apartment. I think your audience knows, you know, from Goodfellas as well as, you know, all that's been written about Lufthansa, that reportedly Jimmy Burke slowly engineered the murder of the other participants, and including Stax Edwards, you know, who was supposed to get rid of the car and I guess got drunk and just they got his fingerprints off the car. So he was identified right away. So all these things, Jimmy Burke, reportedly systematically got rid of all the Lufthansa people. They recovered a small amount of money, but not enough to charge any of the Lucchese people, with the actual crime.
Only one person was ever convicted of it. Right. It was his last name was Werner.
Yeah, Lou Werner.
Lou Werner. He was like one of the inside men.
Right.
And they charged just somewhat recently. They charged
Vinny Asaro,
and right. he didn't end up.
He was acquitted
of it. Can you talk? I know this is a small slice of the anecdotes, but I love when you talked about following Tommy DeSimone right around this time.
Well, then now we all switched on and off. Angelo Seppi was the primary person that I followed, but in talking to Tommy DeSimone was very good at eluding the surveillance. We very rarely lost Angelo. But Tommy DeSimone had successfully eluded surveillance on more than one occasion. So what they did get authorization for Tommy was to get a beacon transmitter installed in his, attached to his car, which you'd be able to find out where he was. It wasn't a listening device, but it was a transmitter. So a former squad mate, Richie Micah, in the days before Christmas, so this you're talking about 10 days after the actual robbery, as Richie told me when I spoke with him about this, to get my memory refreshed, Christmas Eve. So it was the 23rd when he and another agent, Andy Conlin, were assigned by Steve Carbone to do periodic spot checks at Tommy's house to try and locate the car so they could put the beacon transmitter in. Authorization had been received from the court, and now it was running out. I don't know what the exact date was for it to run out, but
you have a window. You have a window that you need to be able to get the device installed.
Correct. So they were very nervous about getting this done, and that on the evening of the 23rd, which I think Richie told me was a Saturday, all of a sudden Tommy pulls up to his house, and now no cell phones. Richie runs to a nearby phone booth, hoping that he's still going to be there when he gets back. Tell Steve Carbone, I need help out here. He's here. So with that, Richie gets back. Tommy DeSimone, with that, comes walking out of the house. And now Richie's following him on his own on Liberty Avenue. He stops in a club for about 15, 20 minutes and then proceeds to Jimmy Burke's house in Howard Beach. So at this point, they're communicating by radio. And Steve Carbone, our supervisor, and several other people respond to the vicinity of Jimmy Burke's house. That Tommy has pulled the car up onto into the on sidewalk, literally, where Jimmy Burke lived was kind of a remote area of Ozone Park by the weeds there. And he pulled up on the sidewalk. Still, they didn't feel comfortable. It appeared to those that were there that there was an all-night card game going on inside. They could kind of hear, talking, and there was a sliding glass door leading onto a patio in the rear of the house. So the way that Richie had described it was there came a time where it's starting to get light out, and they just made a command decision to go out, and Richie would slip underneath the car and install the beacon transmitter, which is what he did. And he said, as he's coming from beneath the car, he sees this big dog appear at the patio door from inside. How and why the dog never barked at Richie, he had no idea. And he says, I looked up and I saw Steve Carbone standing there with his gun drawn. And I kidded Steve later and said to him, why'd you have your gun drawn? What were we going to do, shoot somebody if they came out? So in any event, it was successfully installed. But once again, that very week, the latter part of the week, Tommy DeSimone was never heard from again. Yeah. Presumably, that's right around the time, as is depicted in the movie, that he was whacked, when he was promised to be made.
Let me ask you something, and this is an aside, but My research into Lufthansa, and I've done more than the average researcher. I've been on a couple television specials that dive into Lufthansa. I've interviewed a number of people like yourself that work the case. I was told, and I'm pretty confident in this, but I want to get your take on it.
Yeah.
That Tommy DeSimone's undoing had more to do with him sleeping with people that he shouldn't have been sleeping with, than Lufthansa, and that he had, and this is a part of Goodfellas that they never addressed, but there was like a love triangle or a quadrangle going on between Karen, the Lorraine Bracco character, who was married to Henry Hill, the Ray Liotta character, and they show Ray Liotta as a womanizer, but they don't show Karen as somebody that was stepping out on Henry. And in real life, she was having an affair with Pauly Vario, the boss, the Paul Sorvino character. And at some point around Lufthansa, Tommy DeSimone either made a play for her or got physical with her. And Paul Vario at that point said, "You're too much of a headache." And it just so happens that Lufthansa had just had. So it was like a perfect storm that ended up with him getting killed. It wasn't just Lufthansa. Had you heard that?
Only whispers, you know, only things that I've read, but I can't speak to that. And I don't remember anybody, you know, during the course of surveillance, you know, Tommy was a handsome guy, and we did hear that he was a ladies' man, but I can't speak to the specifics that you're very, very well could be true, but I can't speak to that.
He was tall. He was tall and like strapping. He wasn't a small.
No. Is this depicted in the movie? No. And one thing that, you know, I'm kind of leaving out here, Ed McDonald, who actually portrays himself in the movie.
Ed was on we had Ed on the show a year or two ago. Want to talk about, you guys are both on the Mount Rushmore.
So Ed's the wealth of information. So they have the debriefing Henry Hill, and Ed asks him, after exhaustive, you know, providing all his knowledge and kind of telling him same thing that, you know, that they do with any of these guys that cooperate, you know, you'd be catching one lie, all the deals are off, you know. And so, Henry, is there anything else? You've told us about this. You've told us about that. You're laying out all these things. Is there anything else? Almost as an offhanded comment, Henry says to Ed, "Well, I don't know if you'd be interested. We did fix a couple of college basketball games." And Ed's, you know, they were like flabbergasted. And Ed's a BC graduate, Boston College graduate.
And played basketball at BC.
And lo and behold, he said, "Well, what school are we talking about?" He said, "Boston College." And then probably a week later, on the front page of every newspaper in America, all sporting magazines, the scandal at Boston College. And
according to Ed, Henry Hill mentions it, not even realizing what a big deal it is. According to Ed, Henry Hill didn't realize that was illegal.
No.
He didn't think it was illegal.
No. And that was connected to, you know, when Ray Liotta is getting out of prison and, you know, Karen's worried about, you know, his wife is worried about the money and all this. Don't worry, I met these guys in prison, you know, the Perla brothers. So that all is
intertwined. The Pittsburgh connection.
Yeah, that's all intertwined with the BC stuff. So, but it always struck me as funny that it was almost like an offhanded, casual comment that Henry made. You know, they were the basketball games that we fixed. And of all places, of the thousands of institutions in the United States, it's Ed McDonald's alma mater. It was, you know, pretty humorous.
And that's what jailed Jimmy the Gent. It wasn't Lufthansa. Yeah, it wasn't a murder. Yeah, it was the Boston College point shaving.
Yep. Scandal. Yep.
Can you talk about your work with Tommy Stabile?
Yeah, Tommy Stabile. So in late 83, 84, we had a cooperator who told us that he was good for 5 to 6 insurance jobs a week. Okay, for your audience that might not know what an insurance job is, your car is a lemon. You can't make the payments for one reason or another. You want to get rid of your car. There's always an outlet in these neighborhoods for people to get rid of their cars. And Tommy Stabile was owned a used car dealership on Rockaway Boulevard, operating out of a trailer. It was called Jubilee Auto Sales. And other people that would that were outlets were body shops, repair shops, gas stations, actually big used car dealerships, anybody involved in the automotive business. It was known in the neighborhood that Scott Bernstein, who operates that Gulf station on Atlantic Avenue, he's somebody you can bring your car to and make it disappear. Tommy was one of those guys. So as you said earlier, in that scene in Goodfellas where they're panning through the bar, through Robert's Lounge, and Ray Liotta is introducing all the people. One of them is Anthony Stabile, who is Tommy's brother. So they were members of the crew, all the people that we've mentioned, Jimmy Burke, Tommy DeSimone. They were right there with them. Tommy also was a Shylock and had money out on the street. So our cooperator was into him for about $3,000. So what he suggested was that we be introduced as the informant wanted to get out of New York. He owned a truck repair shop with two other partners in Richmond Hill on Atlantic Avenue, right near the Van Wyck Expressway. And members of the Gambino family, basically the Bergen crew, John Gotti is up and coming at this stage. He used to leave. I distinctly remember he drove a gray Chrysler LeBaron. John did. And anytime something would go wrong with the car, he'd just bring it there and expect these guys to fix it. So they were tired of this crap. They were tired of it. And he said, I want to get out of this life. I want to get out of New York. I'll cooperate with you. I don't really want to testify if I don't have to, but if I have to, I will. I want my family moved out of here. So he began cooperating with us. And what he did was he set my partner and I up with a junkyard that he owned at the corner of Liberty and Montauk in East New York section of Brooklyn. And so the idyllic place for us to have a junkyard, where we were allegedly cutting up cars, windshields, doors, engine parts, all over the place. It was a real true junkyard. And what we did at the outset when we started this operation was I was on a task force with the New York City Police Department, and they provided a old tow truck, a blue and white tow truck with the decal scraped off. That was our tow truck. Didn't go over big with some of the people that we were introduced to, but slowly the cooperator introduced us to people in the Brooklyn, Queens area that were customers of his and giving him give-ups on a regular basis. And he was taking those cars and cutting them up. So again, one of the people was Tommy Stabile. He was into him for about $3,000 and said, this would be a good way to introduce you, in addition to being the new car guys, also to take over the payments. And our office went for that. They thought it was a good idea. And now we were introduced to Tommy Stabile. Very imposing figure, probably close to 400 pounds. No-nonsense guy. For some reason, my partner and I, he liked us right from the outset. There were others that were suspicious, threatened us, if you turn out to be cops, we'll kill both of you. Not such with Tommy. He was an old-school guy, and his belief was that if if anybody turns out to be a cooperator, I'll hold him responsible. So in any event, we began dealing with Tommy, and he trusted us implicitly. Probably maybe the fourth or fifth time that we met with Tommy, he starts telling us about his brother. He points down to the general vicinity of Cross Bay Boulevard. He says, you know, you got to be really careful out there. He said, you know, they killed my brother last year on Cross Bay Boulevard with two other guys. And sure enough, you know, they had, I forget what the date was. Anthony Stabile and two other people were murdered on Cross Bay Boulevard at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, right in the shadows of JFK Airport. So he was actually looking out for us. You know, you can't be too careful who you deal with. Make sure you're careful all the time. And we were flabbergasted. We really were. We come to the trailer one day, and it was on a Monday morning. That Saturday, the world middleweight championship was held, and it was Ray Boom Boom Mancini from Ohio against Livingston Bramble.
Yeah.
And Tommy was not happy with the outcome. Boom Boom Mancini was kind of an idol in the Italian American community. Tommy was not happy with the outcome.
Bramble beat Boom Boom.
Livingston Bramble took the title away from Ray Mancini. So Tommy had told us, I almost threw the fucking bowling ball through the television. That's what he told us when he was watching it. So in that that particular meeting, if your listeners recall, your audience recalls this, Vanessa Williams was the reigning Miss America. And Tommy happened to have a copy of the Penthouse magazine that depicted Miss Williams in a variety of compromising photos with naked woman. And Tommy proceeds. My partner, George, was sitting on the other side. This is all taped. OK, I always was the one who had the tape recorder tucked in my boot with the wire coming up my leg right through my underwear and taped right to my waistband. And so this is all being tape recorded, you know, all being captured on tape. And Tommy's going through each and every photo, and he's asking me, like, basically my opinion. Of course, George is staring at me from feet away, like, how are you going to get out of this? And all I can think of is 2 years from now, I'm going to be on the stand, and whatever the hell I say here is going to be held against me if I'm not careful. So I did manage a couple of oohs and ahs and things like that. And anyway, Tommy had with no cell phones back in those days and were using beepers. So he had beeped us, and that was the normal course of business. He beeps us. We come to the trailer. He has Scott Bernstein's car waiting outside. It's either drivable, or if it's most of these cars were like a lot of them were not drivable. We got a leased flatbed after we got rid of the tow truck, and we were able to convince FBI headquarters to come up with the money to lease us a flatbed. So we had a nice brand new flatbed, and we learned how to tow cars and how to, you know, that we did that for a year. And Tommy wasn't our only customer. Tommy was known as what's called a middleman. He was the facilitator between Scott Bernstein, who wants to get rid of his car, and us, who were supposedly taking the car and chopping it up and making it disappear, bringing the shell to a crusher after we took the tires off, took the radio out, took the windshield out, took the engine out, transmission, all that stuff. And we're selling these parts. This is what everybody thought we were doing. Meanwhile, what we were actually doing was driving the car, transporting the car to Floyd Bennett Field, where we had a hangar of over 150 cars we got from people like Tommy. So this case, we didn't lose one case. Just to give your audience a little bit of information how this worked, Tommy beeps us on a Monday morning. Okay, the 1st of April. We go to his trailer. He's already got Scott's car. He's told Scott. Now, Scott has paid him maybe $200 to $300 for this service. So this is why he's the middleman. So Tommy's got $200 to $300 in his pocket cash. And he tells Scott, I got guys that are coming to get this. Don't do anything. Give me the keys and registration. Don't do anything until we hear from me. So he beeps us. We come to the trailer, we take the car, We drive out to Floyd Bennett Field. Our squad, New York City detectives and agents, meet us. They have a folder for each car. They take the registration. They take the keys. They go back. They make a copy of the registration, a copy of the keys. They give it back to us in a couple of days, maybe Friday, 4 or 5 days later. We go back to Tommy with the keys and registration. The car is gone. He comes to Scott either Friday or Saturday and said, come and get your keys and registration. Either that, those days, either Saturdays, whatever day the owner wants to, owner reports it's stolen to the insurance company. Meanwhile, the New York City Police Department and the FBI have had the car for a week at Floyd Bennett Field, photographed, inventoried, you know, and now Scott's going to say, yeah, I went to the Queens Center Mall and I parked in the parking lot and I had golf clubs in the trunk and all this high value stuff in the car. And I came out and the car was gone. Obviously it's a lie. We didn't lose one case. So, I'm digressing a little bit.
No,
Tommy the reason why he beeped us that particular day, that we were, the Vanessa Williams and the Livingston Bramble Room Bam Boom Boom Mancini, he had set up, he had arranged for us to get a car. So he tells his niece to call that guy. And Tommy, old school, don't talk on the phone, be cryptic, you know, very, very careful. He would tell us, would beep us, would call him, come down here, I got something for you. That's it. That's it. No description of anything. So his niece called. I have him on the phone, Tommy. Tommy gets on the phone. He says, yeah, how you doing? He says, yeah, you know that thing we were talking about? And now, obviously, the guy is talking out of turn and he's pissing Tommy off. And so he says, didn't I tell you to be careful what you say on the phone? He says, stay right where you are. We're coming over. And he hangs the phone up. He's furious. Apparently, this guy's an ex-corrections officer. And Tommy felt he should have known better than to open his mouth on the phone. So he says, let's take a ride. So now the three of us get in the flatbed. The flatbed really is only made for two people. There's no back seat or anything. I'm sandwiched in. My partner, George, is about 260 to 275. Tommy's pushing 400 pounds. I have one leg. I'm straddling the stick, the manual transmission, which is in between both of my legs. I have the recorder in my boot, which my leg is now touching Tommy's leg. I have to say, I was very nervous. You hear these stories about clicking and maybe the thing would click off. I wanted to keep the conversation going and turn the radio up to possibly drown out any sound in case the recorder went off. It was only a micro cassette recorder. I was probably worrying about nothing, but when you have Tommy Stabile sitting next to you, brushing up against you, you know, you want to make sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's. So we drove. We didn't know where we were going. He's telling, make a left, make a right. As it turns out, we were going to the City Line area of Brooklyn and Queens, right actually near where our yard was. And he gets out of the car, and there's a couple of women standing, one with a baby carriage. Now Tommy's furious. He's screaming at this woman. His hands are going back and forth and everything. About 5 minutes later, he gets back into the truck and he says, he's at my trailer. So he says he panicked. He's at the trailer and he's screaming the whole time in the car. Correction officer should have known better. He says, I don't need people like this. You know, like I have the law looking at me all the time. I don't need people like this drawing more attention to me by talking on the phone. You always have to assume the feds are listening on the phone. So we get there and this poor soul is pacing back and forth. He drove there and the car that he's going to give up to us. And so Tommy whacks him. He whacks him right across the head. The guy falls to the ground. He's putting on a little bit of a show for us, but this is a side of Tommy that we really hadn't seen. And we had been warned he's a tough customer and this was all borne out in this meeting. So this guy, I describe him in the book, the Yiddish term, he's a schlub. He didn't know enough to come in out of the rain, so to speak. he just kept it up and kept it up. What he told Tommy was, he said, yeah, he says, I'll give my car to these guys, but can I get the radio and the tires? Tommy whacks him again. He says, what do you mean? He's looking out for us. He says, what do you mean radio and the tires? This is how these guys make a living. He says, you're going to give me the whole fucking car, not half the car, not a third of the car, the whole car. So it went on and on. And then at the end, if this guy was a sad sack, I felt bad for him. He says, how am I going to get home from here? And so Tommy says, why do I give a fuck about how you're going to get home? And so I spoke up and I said, we'll give you a ride. Don't worry about it. Tommy glared at me like that was the wrong thing to say. You're not riding anybody. And he kicked the guy in the ass. And the last time we saw him, he was going down Rockaway Boulevard. But Tommy was quite a colorful character. There came a time at the end of the case where we had gotten so many give ups from Tommy and from other people that we were dealing with. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn told us you have to back off these people, which was a real challenge. But in any event, there came a time, which was December 17th, 1984, where all the people were being arrested. Car owners, middlemen. There were 26 middlemen like Tommy. And they were the important facilitators of the whole thing to the car owners. The time that I've just described to you with that car owner was one of the rare times we ever dealt with a car owner directly. We just always dealt with the middlemen like Tommy. So the story goes, the people that arrested Tommy, the detectives and the agents, when he came calmly, is in the car, real gentleman. He said to them, what's this all about? And they said, do you know two guys named George and Neil? Never heard of them.
That's awesome.
So that was, I felt really good about that. We targeted certain people. They're all brought back to the Queen's office. We wanted to get Tommy to cooperate and other people like Tommy to cooperate because we knew they could provide some information, perhaps on a long-term basis, and you know we could use them. Tommy, old school. We walked in. I had a full beard. My partner had a full beard. We came in our work clothes, and the first thing he said when we walked in was, "Oh, they got used too, huh?" So he, up until that point, he had no idea. So my partner, George, said to him, he says, Tommy, it is George and Neil, but it's actually agents George and Neil. And this is a guy, as I say in the book, that always liked to be in control. And for the first time we saw him, he looked very vulnerable and looked up at us. And he was blinking. His eyes were, he's processing all this. These two guys have been dealing with for the last year, FBI agents. And he said, he looked at us, he said, not bad.
He's great. He's great.
Not bad. He says, you just pulled it off. So he says, I'm not pissed off at you guys. He says, I'm pissed off at the other fucking motherfucker. Yeah, he wasn't happy with the cooperator.
Right.
So we said, listen, Tommy, yeah, you don't want to go back to jail at this stage of your life. This is probably going to be a 5-year stint for you. You don't want to go back. And so good. Hold it right there. He says, you're asking me to cooperate? Well, I mean, you might have to do it. He says, you could send me to jail for 1,000 fucking years. I'm not going to tell on nobody. He says, so why don't we just stop it there? Old school. Tommy never cooperated. But a gentleman at all his court appearances, always had a big handshake for us. Fast forward 5 years later, we hear Tommy gets out. He's now on Atlantic Avenue at a new location, used auto sales. My partner said, let's go by and see what's going on. We were still working together. I really didn't want to. I have to say, I really didn't want to. You know, 5 years can really sour somebody. We put the guy in jail. So he was talking to a couple of people out on the sidewalk, and his trademark thing, as I talked about in the book, even though he was a big guy, he must have, I don't know what kind of size waist he had, but he was always pulling his pants up all the time. And nothing had changed in 5 years. He's standing there talking to these two guys. He's pulling his pants up. So when the two guys left, we started to kind of slowly pull up. And, you know, sharp as could be, Tommy spotted us a block away, two guys in a car. And he kind of looked, and as we got closer, he realized, he goes, oh, pull over, get over here. We talked for about 10 or 15 minutes. could not have been nicer. Talked about, you know, Gotti was now in power. He's talked about, he says, this guy, you don't want to cross this guy. He says, he's crazy. He said, you don't want to get in this guy's way. He'll do anything. After that, Tommy moved to Florida. We were in contact with his parole people down there. And then we recall reading an article. I think it was like 1994 or so. He got involved in a big cocaine conspiracy case and was sentenced to, as I say in the book, he's just one of those guys that just couldn't stay out of trouble. So in 1994, he was sentenced to 14 years for distributing a couple of hundred kilos of cocaine in South Florida. Oh. So, and Tommy has since passed away.
This is awesome. I love all these stories. Let's just finish up with one short anecdote about another, gangster that has a reputation as a gentleman wise guy, Lenny Di Maria from the Gambinos, Lenny the Conductor, alleged to have stepped into the underboss role in the last handful of years. I've never heard one person, whether it be a cop or a crook, say a negative thing about Lenny. He's kind of universally beloved. He's known as a network guy, a connected guy. He knows a lot of people. Came up under Neil De La Croce and the guys in the Gambinos. Just tell us this. You know, you talk about it a little bit in the book. Just tell us your interactions with him.
So it was a Saturday afternoon, and I remember getting called, as did about five or six of us from the squad, that people were offloading stolen merchandise onto rented trucks at one of the piers in Brooklyn. And we all, you know, hot-footed in there, and here's maybe half a dozen guys, a few of them quite big. And we all of a sudden converged, you know, lights and siren, and everybody started to run, which was kind of comical. I don't know where they were going. We were in cars, they were on foot. Some of them were probably, you know, 350 pounds. They all gave up. They all gave up. And one of them was Lenny Di Maria. And as we were putting the handcuffs on him at some stage, he looked up at us and said, "I thought you guys didn't work weekends," which is kind of a legendary, you know, it just goes to show you. I take great pains in the book to talk about a lot of these guys that, as Ray Liotta says, you know, in Goodfellas, you know what? It was all about they carried my mother's groceries home. It was all about respect. And it's a big thing with a lot of these guys. It really is. And we always felt that if you treat 99% of them are very affable and easy to talk to, never, ever got any cooperation out of anybody. I came in that era where it was old school people, and they never, at least when we were working hijackings, none of them ever cooperated. Obviously, in
things changed. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in your tenure, you went from the golden era, you know, when you came in the 70s, where these guys had so much power and influence, and the idea that anybody would break that oath was so foreign. I mean, there'd only been like one Joe Valachi, been one person. And then I would say 10, 15 years into your job, and you worked there for 30. So this is about halfway.
It was a fashionable thing to do.
The floodgates open.
Bosses, Sammy, Joey Messina. I mean, these are all old hijackers, and this is where they all got their start. All of a sudden, everybody's cooperating. It was incredible.
It went from nobody cooperated, and then shameless plug for one of my books, Mafia Prince, Crazy Phil Leonetti from Philadelphia. He was really the first major East Coast mafia figure to cooperate. That was in 89. And then Sammy the Bull followed in 91. And then it was just kind of a free-for-all from that point till now.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an amazing transformation, but that's why you can, you know, we can appreciate somebody like a Tommy Stabile that, you know, who made that comment, you know, you can send me to jail for 1,000 years, you know, and I ain't going to tell on nobody.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's old school stuff. That's old school stuff.
Well, this was awesome. You are always welcome back on the OG pod to promote anything you got going on, to tell old war stories. I could sit here with you for days. We've only done 2 interviews. I think we could do another 5. Tell everyone where they can get stories. Neil's new book.
It's on Amazon. And again, it's called Stories by former FBI special agent and Bronx native Neil Moran. So if you're interested in reading about this and a lot of other exploits of the New York FBI and the New York City Police Department, with whom I closely worked for all of my career, I think you'll enjoy it. And
I really
thank you so much for having me, Scott. This has been a lot of fun and a real pleasure.
Oh, I knew the second I got a hold of your book and read through it. And I'm being completely sincere when I say it's almost 400 pages. But it's a brisk read because you're the way that you create the narrative. I said this in the last episode, I think. It's like you're sitting shotgun in a car with you on the expressway, and you're just driving, telling stories. And each story kind of there's a lot of information, but it's easy to consume. It doesn't feel like it's a 400 page book. You're just always entertained by it. There's always new stories, new people, new characters. Neil weaves his whole, you know, his personal life into it. I think it's just an outstanding read. It's a unique take on this genre, which sometimes is a little bit more, slower burns when you're reading stuff. And I think, Neil, you did a great job of kind of flipping the script on that. And you just drop people. It's like cut to the chase. You drop people right into the middle of the action. And you're a great storyteller. And I really enjoyed the book. I recommend it to everybody.
Very kind. Thank you so much, Scott.
Well, you enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you to Neil for coming on. Well, hopefully we'll have him back at some point in the near future. Thank you to Benny for producing me. Everybody out there in the consumption sphere, please like, share, and subscribe Original Gangsters Podcast. Go check out our Patreon. Go check out our YouTube. Go check out our companion web magazine, The Gangster Report. And for Neil and for Benny, my producer, I'm Scott Bernstein. Original Gangsters Pod, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. We're out.